Conclusion. In any relationship that lasts long enough, it is not just normal, it is inevitable that there will be a time when partners have different levels of interest in sex, different sexual experiences they're interested in having, and different abilities to be sexual. Normal. Not a problem. I've been through it myself, and I've used the tools in this book to find my way back to my certain special someone. For us, the what-if daydream to rebuild emotional accessibility and a deeper grappling with my training as a giver were the most essential parts of the process, along with the foundational tools of confidence and joy, admiration and trust, calm, warm curiosity, and the emotional floor plan. When this book is published and I start traveling again, we'll probably have another dry spell. But now I know for sure that we will always be able to find our way back to each other. You can have that too. The most efficient way to turn that normal, inevitable season into a problem is to worry about it. The sex imperatives and the gender mirage want you to worry, want you to believe that something bad could happen if you jettison their rules and wholeheartedly embrace who you truly are, as you are right now. That's why sometimes joy, loving what's true, can feel scary, like jumping off a cliff in the dark with no idea what will happen next. But isn't that just like life? We step into each new day with no guarantee of what will come next, only a commitment to make of the day and our lives something worth remembering. Our only certainty is that one day we won't get any more days. Over the years that I was writing this book, a friend in her 60s had a stroke. My twin had a serious medical diagnosis. Multiple in-laws had serious medical diagnoses. And I had a serious medical diagnosis. And just as I was finishing the book, my friend Anna died. She was in her 40s, around my age, and she and her wife had been married just 10 years. She was a librarian and a fiber artist and an activist, and I loved her. It's unfair and enraging and a cavernous, harrowing loss. Also, fuck cancer. But Anna always said, queer joy matters. Stay safe. Stay fierce. Practice hope. And so, in the face of life-altering, life-threatening, and life-ending events that happen every day, we practice hope at my house, and we practice pleasure. Life is too short and too uncertain to have sex you don't like, or, at the very least, aren't really curious to try. Couples who sustain a strong sexual connection over the long term are different from each other in myriad ways. But in one way, they are all the same. They collaborate to create a context that makes pleasure easier to access, not least by turning toward each other's whole authentic selves with confidence, joy, and calm, warm curiosity. Be who you truly are, safe in a connection where all of you is welcome. Love who you love. Love how you love. Will other people have opinions? Sure. Keep weeding the garden. Come together, TLDR. 1. Pleasure is the measure of sexual well-being, not how much you want it, how often you do it, with whom, where, what time of day, or even whether you have an orgasm. It's whether or not you like the sex you are having. Life is too short to have sex you don't like. 2. Pleasure is sensation in context. A sensation you experience in a stressful context may feel uncomfortable, while the same sensation in a great sexy context may feel pleasurable. Context is both your external circumstances and your internal state. Your external circumstances include everything from your relationship to your culture, including the sex imperatives and the gender mirage. Your internal state includes everything in your emotional floor plan, including the bonus spaces of your thinking mind and observational distance, plus the state of your physical body. 3. Couples who sustain a strong sexual connection over the long term co-create a context that makes pleasure easier to access. They treat their shared context as a third thing, a joint project or hobby toward which they both feel enthusiasm and investment. Treating it as a shared project on which you and your partner collaborate helps you avoid falling into blame traps where a sexual difficulty is one person's fault. Instead, a difficulty is always a result of a problem with the context, which you can adjust together. 4. Your emotional floor plan includes pleasure-favorable spaces, lust, seeking, play, and care, and pleasure-adverse spaces, fear, rage, and panic grief. Map out your emotional floor plans to see why sometimes it's easy to get to a sexy state of mind and sometimes it's impossible. It will also help you to understand and articulate ways to make it easier for each other to get to the spaces adjacent to lust. 5. Certain sex-positive mindsets allow you to cultivate a shared garden. First, confidence, knowing what's true, and joy, loving what's true, are the keys to creating a sex life that's a great fit for you and your relationship. Second, reconceive changes and differences in sexuality not as a linear progression from broken to normal to perfect, but as an ongoing cycle of woundedness to healing. And you're already perfect wherever you are within that cycle. These tools can free you to turn toward your sexuality and your erotic connection with kindness and compassion. 6. The foundational tools of a great relationship are trust, which is made of emotional accessibility, emotional responsiveness, and emotional engagement, and admiration. Recognizing admirable traits can help you choose a partner worth staying with, and remembering admirable traits in a long-term partner can help motivate you to work through whatever difficulty you may face. 7. Together with the science of behavior change, calm, warm curiosity is the most important tool for solving problems. Curiosity will allow you to address the realities of living in bodies that change with time and even solve the tricky problems that arise in long-term connections, such as how do I get my partner on board with change and how do we move past old hurts. 8. The sex imperatives want you to feel an urgent impulse to change your individual sexuality and your sexual connection to make it more like what it should be. Don't fall for it. No sexual difficulty is worth damaging a great relationship. 9. Perhaps the most ubiquitous and the most insidious barrier between us and our full erotic potential is the gender mirage, the idea that because you were born with a particular set of body parts, there are highly specific rules you must obey about how to live in that body and be a sexual person. Heterosexual-type relationships might struggle the most with the gender mirage, since the relationship does not inherently contradict the rules of the mirage. 10. When we collaborate to co-create a context that makes pleasure easy, not just by addressing our external circumstances, including the sex imperatives and the gender mirage, but by learning to navigate our own and our partner's emotional floor plans, we gain access to what I call the magic trick, a state of ecstasy that connects us to the larger meaning of living a human life. Appendix 1. 10. But Emily, questions. 1. But Emily, I just want my partner to have more sex with me. How do I get my partner to have more sex with me? Listen to chapter 1 again and consider the more specific question, what is it that I want when I want more sex with my partner? Hint, it's not orgasm. You can probably do that on your own. You might also discuss with your partner what it is they don't want when they don't want more sex with you. Do you believe you need the sex? Please visit the It's a Boy handbook in chapter 10, not because you're a boy necessarily, but because that's where I mentioned that sex is not a biological need whose absence can cause you harm. For more details, see chapter 7 of Come As You Are. This is also an excellent moment to revisit chapter 6 regarding admiration. Recalling what you find admirable about your partner can help recalibrate your attention away from your frustration and back toward the human you chose and who chose you. Also, just a quick reminder that sex is not something we get other people to do. It's an experience we co-create by choice. Is what you want when you want more sex with your partner for your partner to be there reluctantly? 2. But Emily, I just want my partner to stop hassling me for sex. How do I get them to stop hassling me? I highly recommend saying something like, please stop hassling me for sex. You might add, hassling hits my brakes and makes it even more difficult for me to want or like sex. You might even say, let's have a conversation about what it is you want when you want sex and what it is I don't want when I don't want sex. It's a rich starting place for a great deal of conversation and mutual learning. If you can avoid treating sex like a power struggle, see chapter 11, and instead like a mutual hobby and shared pleasure. You can also point them to question 1 in this appendix. 3. But where am I supposed to get the time, the energy, the motivation required to create a context that grants my brain access to pleasure? It's a strange new phenomenon, people asking me, how am I supposed to want or like or have sex under these adverse circumstances? Just since the pandemic, really, people have asked me, not rhetorically, how am I supposed to do this? It feels to me like something has shifted in the cultural discourse around sexuality, where people, maybe especially women, feel obliged to be sexual, regardless of the context. And of course, the answer is, you're not. You're not supposed to. If your life circumstances, your stress level, your responsibilities, your relationship, your health, both physical and mental, are just not compatible with creating a context that makes pleasure easier to access, that's just what's true for you in this season of your life. I wish it weren't true for you, for your sake. I think no one who loves you would want you to stay in that state longer than absolutely necessary. But we don't always get to decide what's happening in our lives and relationships. I can say, though, that if you and a partner collaborate to change those circumstances, or if a partner really steps up to make those circumstances less onerous, you might discover that energy is freed up for pleasure. 4. But what if talking about sex is a turnoff? I know I'm supposed to believe consent is sexy or whatever, but I, or my partner, feel like being asked for something makes it more difficult to say yes. Or if I have to ask, it feels like my partner isn't paying enough attention. This question is so hard to answer. Not because it's complicated, but because nobody ever feels satisfied with the truth. Ask yourself and or your partner, what is it about talking about sex that hits the brakes? Do you feel that you shouldn't have to? Then of course it hits the brakes. If you believe talking means there's something wrong, that judgment, like most judgment, is going to hit the brakes. Do you believe your partner should already know what you want, or that you should be able to tell what a partner wants without having to communicate about it? Then once again, of course it hits the brakes. Whatever the reason, it is not the talking that hits the brakes. It's your ideas about the talking. Talking can be hot as hell, but the sex imperatives, apparently want you to believe that speaking your pleasure or desire, asking for guidance or permission, is anti-pleasure. It's supposed to be effortless. You're supposed to just know. You shouldn't have to say it. And if it's not easy, if you do have to talk, everything is ruined. Go back to my experience with Cohen, which I described in Chapter 2. I stopped him. We had to talk about it. The spontaneous desire disappeared in a puff of vapor, and we still shared a lot of pleasure. Are you letting the desire imperative stand between you and the pleasure you could experience if you weren't clinging to the need for spontaneity? 5. But Emily, scheduling is so unromantic and unerotic. I don't care what you say. I want my partner to want me so much, they can't help themselves. Feel free not to schedule sex if that's not a context that makes pleasure easier to access in your relationship. I'll take this opportunity to repeat that desire really isn't the thing. Pleasure is the thing. Put pleasure at the center of your definition of sexual well-being, and all the other pieces will fall into place. And yet, we know that being wanted is among the most common things people want when they want sex. If you want your partner to want you so much they can't help themselves, and your partner wants to want you so much they can't help themselves, collaborate to create a context that makes that easier. Increase things that activate the accelerator, and, even more important, decrease things that hit their brakes. See Chapter 1 here, or for a lot of detail, see Chapter 2 of Come As You Are and the Come As You Are workbook. I also suggest you consider a new version of the questions from Chapter 1. Ask yourself, what is it that I want when I want my partner to want me so much they can't help themselves? This can be a difficult question because it requires acknowledging that you want some pretty vulnerable things. Maybe you want to know that your partner wants all of you, including the parts of yourself you find difficult to accept in yourself. And I bet you can get that in a great relationship. Maybe you want to feel that you are so lovable, so fuckable, that nothing life brings can affect your partner's attraction. And I'm not sure that's something many partners can deliver. Life hits the brakes for a lot of us, no matter how lovable and fuckable we find our partners. Being wanted is a core need related to our need for authentic connection. What other experiences, apart from spontaneous desire, fulfill your need to feel fully, deeply welcome as your whole self in your erotic relationship? You'll notice I'm not offering an approach that requires no effort. We don't sustain passionate, spontaneous sexual desire over the long term. We can only recreate it again and again. And what works to recreate desire will very often be different from what worked last time. Like, remember the movie Groundhog Day, where Bill Murray is doomed to live the same day over and over? And one time, it goes amazingly. So he tries to recreate that same day, doing the same things, trying to force something that happened organically the first time? You can't force it. You can only create a context that makes it easier. Important caveat. That's only if your partner also wants to want you that way. If they are not interested in wanting you that way, then the conversation is, what is it that I want when I want my partner to want me? And what do you not want when you don't want to want me that way? 6. But I shouldn't have to do all this work to make my sex life what it's supposed to be, Emily. You're supposed to be making it easier, not more difficult. Do better. Yeah, that's a thing we've all been taught, right? Sex is just supposed to happen easily, no matter what else we have going on in our lives. I hate to be the one to break it to you, but that is not and never was how it works. Sex depends on pleasure. Pleasure depends on the context. And the context is not always in our control. I 100% own that my advice is much more complicated than try handcuffs or even schedule sex. You are right. I get mad about it too sometimes. Why can't it be easier? I recommend the positive reframe. It's not difficult or work. It's a hobby. It's a mutual interest on which you and your partner collaborate because you both like it. And if you don't both like it, well, the problem isn't that it's so difficult, it's that it's not enjoyable enough to be worth the effort. Fix the pleasure, and the rest will follow. If you're finding it difficult to be motivated because it's not supposed to be effortful, I recommend Chapter 2 of Burnout, which is about assessing both our goals and the amount of effort we think they're supposed to require. Often we get frustrated because something takes much more work than we believe it's supposed to. But actually, that's just how much work it takes. And if we stop judging how much work it takes, we feel more motivated and hopeful and able to notice our progress. Nobody ever said it would be easy. I would say, though, that it can definitely be worth it. 7. Okay, Emily. But what if I follow your advice and I ask my partner to try something new? I started the conversation gently and requested that they take their time and respond as non-judgmentally as they can. But my partner not only says no, they judge me, thus fulfilling my worst nightmares. Where's your brain science for that, huh? I don't have any brain science for it, but it is an important question. You have a lot of options in that moment. You could, of course, never speak to the person again, pack all your things in the dead of night, move 1,000 miles away, and change your identity. I'm mostly kidding about that, but what if your something new is, I'm trans, or I'm queer, or I'm kinky and feel most fulfilled as a person when I regularly spend time in sub or dom space? And what if your partner's reaction is, not just a reaction in the moment, but a deeply rooted moral judgment? What if you told your person who you are, and they said, nope? In a conversation like that, know ahead of time that the stakes may be relationship-endingly high. Talk to a queer or kink or trans-competent therapist in advance. Approach your partner with confidence, knowing what's true, and joy. Loving what's true. Do not trade your true self for someone else's approval. Refer to what you need in Chapter 10. You need to be who you truly are and to be welcomed in a loving community. Maybe you've already spent years sacrificing who you are in order to feel welcome. When you began this conversation with your partner, you were seeking to create that context where all of who you are is welcome. Maybe your partner will need spacious time to process. Maybe your partner can't. There are people who will love all of you, and you deserve to find those people. But a lot of the things we bring to our partner are not about our identities, but our curiosities, interests, pleasures, and questions. The stakes aren't as high. Your partner's unwelcoming reaction to that kind of something new could still be about more than the specific thing you're asking about. It might be about a history in your relationship of them going along with what you wanted even when they were ambivalent, but now they're finally speaking up. It might be about your partner's individual history with the specific thing you're discussing, or with things they've been taught to feel and believe about different sexual experiences. And while I want to say, explore your partner's response with them with calm, warm curiosity, I know full well that it's going to be really tough to be there for your partner when you're hurting from their reaction. Back to basics. The process of dealing with the feelings caused by a problem is separate from the process of dealing with the problem itself. In this moment, both of you have a ton of difficult feelings. Difficult feelings can hurt, even physically hurt. But they hurt a little less when you can love them as well as you love the most comfortable parts of each other. Easier said than done, I know, which is why I explain how to do it with a deliberately silly metaphor in Come As You Are. Imagine that each difficult feeling you experience is a sleepy little hedgehog that you find snoozing in the middle of your favorite chair. You can't relax until you deal with this unexpected visitor. Find out its name. Its name is likely to be similar to one of the primary process emotions I mentioned in Chapter 3. Loneliness. Sadness. Anger. Worry. Find out what it needs. It might have a specific story, maybe about feeling betrayed or about being exhausted and needing more help. Ultimately, what it longs for is to be set free, to go live in its true home, a hedge outside your emotional life. Alas, you can't just pick it up and drop it outside your door. You have to help it get what it came for when it wandered into your mental home in the first place. To find out what it needs, you have to listen to it with, kindness and compassion. Also, patience and curiosity. Also, therapy. These conversations are difficult. You're allowed to recruit some expert help. 8. But Emily, the desire imperative is just so deeply embedded in my brain. How will I ever stop beating myself up for my responsive desire? Yeah, you might never be 100% done worrying about desire. It's a cycle of woundedness to healing. You're always moving through it. The desire imperative had a long time to entrench itself in your brain, carving a deep, wide wound in your sexual garden. It will take many experiences of feeling free from the desire imperative, and then feeling broken again, and then feeling liberated again, and then feeling ashamed again. But gradually, the phases of feeling broken or ashamed will shorten and ease, and the phases of feeling normal, confident, and joyful will expand to fill more and more of your days. It's not about never feeling broken. It's about welcoming feeling broken as an opportunity to practice remembering that you are not and never were broken. 9. I get that it's important to be patient and meet my partner where they are and whatever, but Emily, how long am I supposed to wait and be patient before I just give it up as hopeless? The question here ultimately is, how do I know when to quit? Which is a bigger kind of question than a book about sex can answer. Fortunately, Amelia and I do answer it in Chapter 2 of Burnout. There's a mechanism we call the monitor, and understanding how it works will help you know how to tell if you've crossed your threshold and need to stop investing time and energy in something. Then, if you decide to quit, the question becomes more complex. What precisely are you quitting? The whole relationship? The possibility of any sexual connection? And for how long? Are you taking a break? Or is this a permanent change? You are allowed to stop trying if trying no longer has any hope of resulting in the change you need. Also, really do go read Chapter 2 of Burnout because it has some important details about understanding what your goal is and assessing if that goal is actually right for you, and about changing your brain's opinion about how difficult a given goal is supposed to be, aka criterion velocity. Some goals are much more effortful than we've ever been told. 10. But Emily, it's actually true that my partner is the problem. I've tried everything. They refuse to change. They're not even willing to consider change. They won't treat our shared context as a third thing that we turn toward with mutual curiosity. They think I should just shut up and suck it up. Okay. I've offered a lot of options for what to do when you'd like to create change with a partner, or when you want to address old hurts, or when you want to understand their experience more clearly or express your experience more clearly. If you have approached your partner with confidence and joy, with calm, warm curiosity, and they are unwilling to reciprocate, maybe your partner truly is the problem, and there certainly are times when they are, in particular, when they're deeply in the thrall of the gender mirage, for example. Not all relationships can be saved. Not all relationships are worth saving. Appendix 2. Because biology. Although the mere existence of transgender, non-binary, agender, gender fluid, and other gender diverse people is in itself all the evidence we need that gender is not binary, some people really struggle to accept that not everyone's internal experience of gender is directly tied to the shape of their genitals. If you or someone you know is struggling in this way, I hope this helps. It's true that when we discuss humans as a species, we are discussing a sexually dimorphic species, meaning we have some individuals with anatomy constructed to produce a large number of extremely small gametes, and other individuals with anatomy constructed to produce a limited number of huge gametes. But this population-level description is not accurate as an individual-level description. That is, just because something is a true statement about a population, e.g., a sexually dimorphic species, doesn't mean it's true about every single one of the individuals within that population. As it happens, there are lots of binaries we impose on bodies and sexuality beyond gender identity that aren't really binaries when we look more closely. Take chromosomes. The usual story we tell is that an ovum slurps up a sperm with a Y sex chromosome or an X sex chromosome. This is where we get chromosomal sex. Let's call XY chromosomally male and XX chromosomally female. But there are a variety of other combinations of sex chromosomes, like XXY, which is Klinefelter's, XYY, which is creatively called XYY syndrome, or just X, with a missing or partially missing second X. That's called Turner's. And none of these are a person's identity. It's literally just their chromosomes. And chromosomes are non-binary. How about anatomy? I've already mentioned intersex folks whose genitals are not obviously it's a girl or it's a boy shaped when they're born. Their evidence that anatomical sex is also not binary. As with chromosomes, the usual story we tell is that XX fetuses develop external genitalia that adults seeing them on a newborn baby will call girl, and XY fetuses will develop external genitalia that adults will call boy. In general, the girl genitals mean that the urethra is separate from the phallus, clitoris in this case, and the boy genitals mean that the urethra is somewhere on the glands of the phallus, penis in this case. But some people with XY chromosomes have hypospadias, where the opening of the urethra is somewhere on the shaft of the phallus rather than on the glands. And in congenital adrenal hyperplasia, or CAH, a person with XX chromosomes might have a vagina and urethra that converge and open from the body somewhere close to the clitoris, which might be on the larger end of the spectrum and look a lot like a penis. Both intersex conditions are caused by genetic variations that are not the sex chromosomes. Like chromosomes, human genitals are non-binary. And again, the shape of someone's genitals doesn't determine their identity. Only the person's internal experience determines their identity. There are other biological aspects of the thing we call sex, gonadal sex, and hormonal sex, for example, and none of them are actually just two options. There's no level of analysis within the body where biological sex is genuinely two. Yet, for complicated reasons with deep historical roots, we grow up learning that it's only XX and XY, only vulvas and penises, only girls and boys. I consider it part of the gender mirage that we're taught about just two chromosomal possibilities and not any others. We are taught to see our biology from a point of view that creates a mirage, something you can definitely see, but isn't really there. Often, it disappears once you shift your point of view by learning how diverse biological sex really is. I get angry sometimes when I think about how we're lied to about this stuff. It leads intelligent, compassionate people to be wildly confused when they think about people whose gender identities don't match their anatomically assigned role. They say, there's just two because they were never taught that, in fact, there are not just two. There are many levels that a human has a sex, and not one of them is actually just two. So, biology exists, and none of it is binary when it comes to sex. Human psychology, inextricable from human biology, also exists, and none of it is binary when it comes to gender identity. Culture, inextricable from psychology, exists too. And we know from the various cultures with other gender categories that these two are not binary. It's all a mirage, shimmering over the reality of expansive human diversity. Alfred Kinsey, groundbreaking mid-century sex researcher, began his career as a biologist. He was the world's leading expert on the gall wasp, publishing a 500-page treatise on the topic in 1930. I return to him for inspiration, again and again, for the crucial precision with which he wrote about the nature of intraspecies variety. He said, "We may begin our analysis of species by an examination of a few individuals taken in the field. We then become impressed with the truth of the assertion that no two individuals are exactly alike. And if we extend our investigations to several dozen individuals, we shall be confused by the varying characters that enter into any population which ordinarily passes as a species. But if, on the other hand, we extend our examination to several hundred such individuals, we shall become impressed with another opinion, namely that there are many more points of uniformity than of variation among individuals." It is based on his work that I began teaching one of my central messages, that all of us are made of the same parts, organized in different ways. We are all the same. We are all different. No two alike. That's normal. Acknowledgements. Writing a book is, as Amy Poehler puts it, terrible. It gets done not because I sit in splendid isolation at my keyboard, allowing genius to flow, but because I have long conversations and welcome critical feedback from people I admire. It also gets done because a lot of people help me keep my day-to-day life functioning while I forget to eat or bathe. This is the page where I get to say thank you to all of them. Gratitude to the beta readers who read early drafts and offered invaluable feedback about what was helpful and what could go. Steph O'Terry, Stephanie Ellis, Kelsey Peterson, Kitty May, Grace, Erica Moen, Sara Nasrzadeh, Chessa Grasso Hickox, Karen Rain, Elise Clark, Elise Gonzalez, Elizabeth Goodstein, Kat Stark, Hannah Marcus, Lucy Fielding, Nadine Thornhill, Jacqueline Friedman, and Heather Corinna, among many others who preferred to stay anonymous, not to mention literally thousands of newsletter subscribers who responded so thoughtfully to surveys and questions. And there are my teachers whose books changed this book. Everyone listening to this book, go listen to their books too. Adrienne Marie Brown, Andrew Garza, Julian B. Carter, Kai Cheng Tom, Lucy Fielding, Peggy Klein Plotz, Saida Hartman, Sabine Selassie, Sue Johnson, and Trisha Hersey. Also, my friend, Anna Clutterbuck Cook. My sister, Amelia. My literary agent, Lindsay Edgecombe. My editor, Sarah Weiss. And last but most, my illustrator and marital euphemism, R. Stevens. I love you. This is Emily Nagoski. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Come Together, the science and art of creating lasting sexual connections. This program was directed by Beth Hicks, executive producer Diane McKiernan, engineered by Peter Acker, edited by BookTrack. Text copyright 2024 by Emily Nagoski. Production copyright 2024, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.